Welcome to the Amazon Legends Podcast, where we have real stories about making it big on Amazon. Our guests are CEOs of large companies and entrepreneurs who became powerful sellers, also experts specializing in helping sellers, and both former and current Amazon employees who will give us an insight from behind the scenes. Here's your host, Nick Urisin.
Welcome to another episode of Amazon Legends. My next guest today is a serial entrepreneur. I've known him for a long time. We talked a few times, and he is the definition of serial entrepreneur. So he built Skubana, sold it. He built Prosper Show that everybody knows about in the Amazon community, sold it. He built an Amazon seller called Crucial, sold it. And now he's building another company called Prophecy. So he's the founder and CEO of Prophecy, which is an AI-based dynamic pricing engine for private label sellers. And when he's not working, he works on personal growth, his son, and also he DJs. And I also found out he does scuba diving, which is my passion. So with that, everybody, meet my guest, Chad Rubin. Welcome to the show, Chad.
Thank you, Nick. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. People, I'm sure, people want to know the secret to building these companies and then being able to sell them. But we'll get to that after the show. So you're building a new company now, which is all about dynamic pricing for private label sellers. So I'm assuming there is some kind of intelligence going on to figure out the right price. So how do you know the right price for an item?
Well, you don't know the right price. You need to find out the right price, and that's what we do.
So tell us the, first of all, having built several businesses, there's the business approach, right? So as a private label seller, you're building a brand. Nobody else is selling that item, and then you're looking at others. How do you know where to start? What is the starting point for you?
Well, so I'll share with you, so just a correction. I didn't sell my e-commerce business yet, but I've been working on turning it around. So as my business has been struggling and many other Amazon brands have been struggling in this time period with inflation, every cost imaginable is rising. PPC inflation, supply chain inflation. I was staring at a tree in Florida and I was like, wait a minute, what's the biggest lever that nobody's pulling and why? And the biggest lever is pricing, right? Because that's actually what flows down to the bottom line, but nobody changes it. Everyone changes ad spend and no one changes price. So that's really where I started analyzing our pricing approach, because our pricing approach was very static at the time. And I was like, well, why can't pricing be dynamic and dynamically change? So that's where I really began on my search around, okay, well, why aren't sellers changing price? Well, it's really hard. They're receiving a lot of bad information out there. And the information could be like a lot of gurus talk about price and they're like, oh, just raise price. But actually, it's hard to practice. It's very messy on Amazon and it's a major blind spot. So the idea is that pricing isn't one size fits all, and you need to come up with pricing that's based in reality, where you align your product price to data to the customer. I'm going to stop there.
Product price, data, and customer.
So that's where you start, right? You have to align, calibrate the price to the right buyer that's willing to buy it. And so the problem, well, there's a lot of problems around pricing, but nobody is changing it. And I was like, well, what if I'm leaving a lot of money on the table? And that was actually how I started Prophecy. I started changing pricing myself. So I'm happy to walk the audience through my approach to manually doing it. And then why I started building AI, true AI, which is a very clear delineation around true AI around pricing and pulling in all the signals to optimize for the optimal price to maximize profitability.
So as far as the price, I work with private label sellers and I always remember this one. So I had this client, she sold skincare products. And I told her, look, your pricing seems to be too low. And she said, we can't sell higher because then we'll be too expensive compared to our competition. So that's ultimately what people are afraid of, you know, if they increase their price too much or they launch with a high price, then they'll be pricing themselves out. So how do you get around that that initial fear of pricing it too high?
So Amazon has something called a knock-on effect. So your price today affects your orders tomorrow. So if you raise your price, there can be a negative consequence. And if you lower your price, it could be a negative consequence. And so if you raise your price, for example, you may make more money, it may slow demand. And if demand slows, then you lose your BSR. If you lower price and everyone else follows and it becomes a pissing contest, if you lower price, then maybe your unit velocity increases and it may not offset the decrease in price to maximize profit. So there is an art and a science around it. There's a lot of experimentation and nobody actually knows what the optimal price is. And that's really where I started to begin and see, okay, well, all the manual work that I'm doing and all the spreadsheets I built around managing price were actually really hard and not scalable. So the beautiful thing about AI is that AI is faster than we are as humans. It's less expensive, a lot less expensive. It works all the time and works as it should. And it makes less mistakes. And it's capable of consuming billions of data points and making the optimal decision and being trained over time. So that's where I started pivoting into AI about a year and a half ago. And luckily, ChatGPT made AI mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, ChatGPT these days is changing everything. So walk us through the approach to changing the price and then determining and then also dynamically changing.
Okay. So if you're going to do this manually, you create a spreadsheet and you have a tab and you label the tab an ASIN. And in that spreadsheet, every day you have your current price and the price you want. You have your landed costs. You have all the fees in it. You get to your gross profit. Then you subtract out advertising and you have your X advertising profit. And you also include your BSR and you can also include your inventory quantity. And then you also start adding your competitors based on a specific keyword to that with their price to see how they react and their BSR to understand how Amazon positions them as you make price changes. So you start tracking this and you really want to go into this with the proper intention, especially if you're a private label brand on Amazon. So the intention for Prophecy is we want to maximize profit, but not everybody wants to maximize profit. I know that doesn't make sense, but a lot of people are in their honeymoon period of their product launch and may just want to keep the lowest price possible to get as much velocity going. That's not where we play. Our goal is we take a high performing, high velocity merchant who's already harvesting profit and we maximize profitability without sacrificing your BSR. And mm-hmm. So that's how manually you do. You create all the signals you would think of, even sessions, conversion rate. You can even start pulling in data from Jungle Scout or Helium 10 to understand units sold and revenue. And you start building a model and a discipline and a strength around your pricing. And what then you want to do is you want to start integrating and centralizing that price in a spreadsheet so that it's cross-functional because pricing affects every part of the business. It affects the finance team. It affects the ads team that you have, whether they're in-house or out-of-house. But it affects everything. And you start having meetings and discussing and having a proper rhythm discussing these things internally. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So just going back to recording your price, I mean, you already know this is your stuff. You know the price, you know what inventory you have, and you can get your BSR. But the competitors, so this is you doing this by keyword?
So you can do it manually by keyword. Prophecy specifically, we do a reverse ASIN lookup for your listing. We go out and scrape and find your competitors.
Okay. So based on what Amazon system recognizes as your competitors, you fetch those.
Correct.
And then you are tracking. So tell us, I mean, obviously, when you use technology, everything becomes much, much more efficient. But the principle behind it is what I'm interested in the most. So what are you looking at as far as your competitors? What is the information that's relevant to determining your price?
Yeah, so on competitors, for example, you're looking at their price, you're looking at their inventory, you're looking at the number of competitors that you have, you're looking at their reviews, the quality of the reviews, the recency of those reviews, the ratings, which is the quality. So like you have a treasure trove of information at your disposal. Like it's a beautiful thing, actually, selling Amazon. It's a blessing and a curse, right? You have all this data that you can unlock. The problem is, how do you unlock it? So not only do you have your competitive data, right? You have contextual elements like seasonality, as an example. You have your past sales data that you can pull. You have your session and conversion rate data that you can pull in. You have your category information. You have even macro environment factors. All of this can be baked into a model and essentially connecting the dots and sifting, finding the signal in the noise is really how models are built. Like there's nobody that's better equipped to do this than an algorithm.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And then based on what those data points are, you know, what actions you take. So that's pretty much the essence, right?
Yeah. So then to take it one step further is that then you have all these signals and it creates these if-then statements. It creates its own if-then statements to get you to the outcome that you want to achieve. So humans, there's a lot of traditional repricers out there. Many of them are not focused on the private label market or brands, but they're just if-then statements. And you'd have to create so many if-then statements to really get to the core essence of what an algorithm can do. So the next step that we've built is something we noticed in our testing that a lot of Amazon sellers rarely, if at all, change price. And they're changing spend all the time, but they're not changing price. So just like Facebook, if you go on Facebook, you have no connections, you have no likes, you have no followers, you have no dwell time on a video, Facebook or Instagram wouldn't know it to serve you.
Right.
And our model didn't know it to serve our users and our clients because they never changed price. There's no pattern recognition there. So then we were like, okay, this is great. What we can do is we developed a phase. We call it the hyper-learning phase. And the hyper-learning phase essentially experiments with pricing and oscillates your pricing in small increments to see how Amazon's A9 algorithm reacts to our price changes and to see how your competitors react to price changes. And so we start testing different pricing at different buckets of price changes, and we learn, the model observes in this period, it's about a month roughly, it experiments, and it's learning all independently of the Prophecy team. And we take those learnings and we essentially train the model on the next 3 months to properly dynamically change pricing for you based on what it's learned. It's really amazing technology.
Yeah. So one thing that I want to also emphasize is I'll just take a side note here and then just tell you a little bit about this, because this, when I first came across this concept of dynamic pricing, that was in 2009.
Okay.
And I was selling on Amazon, and there was no private label business. It was all reselling those days. So I was reselling. I was in beauty category. So I was able to tap into supply, you know, with suppliers. I had, you know, wholesalers, distributors, whatever. So that was not the issue. The issue was pricing, because in order to capture the buy box, you had to really have the buy box. You had all these different metrics. Price was not the only thing. Price was obviously the main driver, but that was not the only driver that Amazon cared for to give you the buy box. So I built this whole dynamic pricing platform. It automated, there's a lot of business rules, because you may your price may be going up. I should say the price of the item may be going up, and you may have limited amount of inventory. You don't necessarily want to undercut anybody to get the price. So versus you have a lot of inventory and the price is going down, that's a different situation. So all those things, I automated the whole thing. So and then my system will automatically change the price. So, and it was like turning on the tap and the orders would start flowing in. So I am very much intrigued with the dynamic aspect of it. So in your case, when you figure out, oh, it's one thing for the AI to say, okay, this should be the price. It's another to go in and change the price, right? So that you are actually going in automatically and changing the price of the item, right?
Yeah, so you give us your minimum price, you give us your max price, you give us the boundaries, you give us your landed costs, and then we do the rest.
Okay. So one of the issues with Amazon on private label sellers is they don't let you increase the price too much. Or if you reduced it, then they don't, you know, you have to really take time. So talk to us about that. What is the best way to manage that?
Well, so if you're doing it manually, you have to be monitoring your buy box suppression, right? Your listing health. For us, we built in suppression monitoring into the platform. So if there is an issue, or if we do find the threshold that Amazon sees for your specific ASIN and there's suppression, we reset back to the original price, give you the buy box again. And the model then learns from that and understands that that is the new threshold.
I see. So as far as the, so I had a guest, he said something interesting. Yeah, he said, you have to be careful what, whether to reduce your price or offer a discount or discount your price. So there is a difference between reducing your price and discounting, right? Discounting can be done through coupons and promo codes and things like that. So in your case, you are working directly with the price itself. Then how do the promos and coupon codes apply?
Yeah, so we ask our clients to hold on coupon codes. We haven't built that functionality into the platform yet, but during the experimentation phase, we ask you hold off on promotions or give us a heads up if you have a lightning deal happening so that the lightning deal, because you have to be a specific percentage discount from the original price. And so that becomes the min price that we're allowed to go down to. So, but we haven't actually built in the couponing promotions into it. So we're just working with the listing price right now.
Okay.
And we're seeing, and by the way, we're seeing like amazing results, right? And so if you can see amazing results with the year of the model that we built, as we start to add to it, it'll start to even improve profitability for the brands that use us even further.
So is your system primarily focused on increasing the price? Or
it's not necessary? It's not. We conservatively go up and we aggressively go down. So again, it's figuring out what is the sweet spot. And so for us, it's dynamically changing price, and you could have a different price on a different day because maybe some people have more of a willingness to buy on a specific day. It's almost like Uber surge pricing, right? Uber has something called surge pricing, which changes dynamically based on supply and demand. In this case, we not just have supply and demand information coming from Amazon, but we also have a whole host of other nuggets to bite on to figure out where there's value leakage for your product.
Right, because it's the, I mean, price is everything because it starts the top line. And after that, everything else is an expense, right?
Correct. And so if you think about growing up in price, it's quite simple, right? You increase price and everyone is saying, hey, increase price right now. Now's the time to increase price. And sometimes that might be the right decision. On the other side of things, like lowering price might actually be the right decision, even though it sounds counterintuitive that there's inflation and there's all these costs that are rising. Because you can lower price, you might increase your demand. What happens when you increase demand? Well, you increase your unit velocity, right? And it offsets the lower of the price. And then it essentially produces more profit dollars. Now there's this knock-on effect that happens where not only do you produce more profit dollars after that, but you might actually lower your BSR, which increases your competitive positioning on Amazon, increases your placement, offsets your PPC spend, and boom, now you're making even more money because you're not renting for that spot. You own that spot now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. Totally. I mean, it's always the struggle where, you know, you want top line growth or you want bottom line growth. And the top line growth will come from reducing the price a lot of the times. And bottom line growth will come from reducing the expense, but then that comes at the expense of reduced top line, right?
So if you I think as a business, you need to have an intention, right? Like, I don't think that a business is like, hey, let's grow revenue at all costs. I mean, I think that is a mentality that was happening from 2015 to 2021. I think there's been a shift now. And it's growth at the lowest cost, but it's profitable growth. So there's definitely a paradigm shift that's happened in the marketplace for brands, for sure. Yeah. And so it shouldn't be on a waxing level of a company, but it should be actually on a product level, meaning if you're, I don't know, selling this lighter, you might want to just increase velocity to get better positioning. That's not what we do at Prophecy, but you may want to maximize your BSR as the outcome. Whereas this water bottle, I might be in a great position. I might be a number 3 on page 1 in the SERP, and I'd want to stay there, but I want to harvest as much profit dollars as possible. Mm-hmm. And so we figure out what is the right number, because if Amazon's a living, breathing system, so is pricing. It's not just a number.
Sure. I mean, pricing is the main driver. I mean, you have the filters and everything else. So when people are searching, pricing is everything. And a lot of the times the pricing is not really the right pricing. How about situations when I say it's not the right pricing? Some products are underpriced because they didn't know how to price it. And they don't really understand the value of it. Or a lot of the times, something that's priced in a way that it looks overpriced, but they don't do anything to differentiate themselves. So that's another thing, right? So do you do anything with the content? Is that a factor in your consideration?
We're pulling in the content. We're not using AI to change the content. Right now, we're really just focusing on price in the SERP. Now, it doesn't mean in the future we won't have some stuff that's interesting and available to sellers, hint, hint. But right now, we don't have that.
When I say content, I'm referring to, do you make the content part of the consideration to increase the price? Like, for example, they may, the demand may go one way, and then suddenly the system may say you can afford to increase the price, but really they don't have the right content for it. It's not.
Yeah. So we're working with some pretty large sellers who already have like hyper optimized their listings. Okay. Infographics are all there. Their videos are there. A+ content. It's all branded. The bullet points. That's not where we focus. We're like, we just want to take something. We're not a lifeboat, we're a speedboat. We want to take something and maximize what you're pulling out of it.
Okay. So how about inventory? Is that
we do consider inventory for sure.
So how does that impact your pricing strategy? Or let's talk about this from perspective of a seller. How should the seller factor their inventory position into their pricing?
So, firstly, usually we're taking on sellers who have because we're running an experiment, right? And you need to have the right quantities on hand so you don't run out of stock, because that'll affect us making you more money. So when we do bring on sellers, we're actually cross-checking their information around how much velocity they're selling, if they have enough proper inventory position to hold them over during this time period. And sometimes things happen where, for example, they're going to run out of stock. And again, we're here to help them make more money. So we'll help them start eking out more profits on the way up with price increases to offset or slow the velocity a bit further? And there's many schools of thought about this, right? Some people say, hey, I want to actually sell out quick, capture the BSR that's turning more velocity so that when I do get back in stock, we're at that BSR and at that position. Everyone has their own perspective on it. I'm just sharing with you, we can go on both ends of the spectrum, but that's what we've been seeing with sellers. Typically, we're taking them on, then they have sufficient stock levels to change pricing. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, this is very useful in terms of understanding the dynamics. I have one question for you, which was really, because remember I told you this, my history with dynamic pricing and building it. So as I started using this, and then a couple of years went by, then these reprices started to show up here and there. And so first, you know, when you build a product and then suddenly you see somebody else, you kind of become a little bit discouraged. And then I looked at what was available, and they all needed the minimum and the maximum. And in the end, I thought, oh, I understand this. So I have to give them the minimum and the maximum. And what they are really doing is they are incrementally changing the listing price by simply automating the mechanics of it with Amazon. What I had focused on was what should my minimum be and what should my maximum be? So can you share with us, I know you require that from the seller, but from business standpoint, how should a seller determine the minimum and the maximum for what the items they sell?
Yeah, so in the spreadsheet that you give us for our platform, you can give us the min or the max, or you can give us, we can calculate what your 0% margin is. And by the way, a lot of sellers are pricing at 0% margin. It's super interesting. So we're discovering that, but we can programmatically find out what their net margin is on a specific product. And then we use that as our minimum, right? Because we don't want you to be negative net margins on a product, right? Our goal is to make you as much money as possible. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so we're doing a lot of that in our spreadsheets, but we do ask for min and max, or you can, again, you can put in your 0% margin number, or we can find that for you.
And how about the maximum? How do you calculate the maximum?
And so some sellers can put in a max. Now, some sellers are selling, say, on other platforms where they don't want Amazon to go above a certain number. That's one piece of information. The other thing is that you can actually leave the max blank if you want, right? Where it's as much as the model is willing to go, it's willing to go, and it'll do that work for you to figure out what is that sweet spot. So you could leave the max blank if you'd like.
Yeah. I mean, maximum price is always, what are the conditions for the maximum price to go even higher? Because sometimes there is demand. Like I remember, totally by coincidence, right before, like 4 months before the pandemic, I started working with a client, and they manufactured masks, but they specialized in like woodworkers and construction workers and, you know, sports, leisure, that kind of stuff. And then suddenly the pandemic hit. Now everybody wants masks. There was no price. It was no maximum. They were just trying to get. So at that point, I mean, this is not price gouging. It's just simply the demand goes up. Then supply is limited. What happens to the price, right? So it's the dynamics, and determining what is the right price to sell was always a challenge, and it was a guess. So maximum is always tricky.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I think most people are just guessing, right? They're just marking it up based on a cost, or they're marking it to the market, which is the competitors, and they just leave it there. So one of the things I've seen in the space is that nobody would leave, if you're spending $10,000 a month on ad spend, you would just never leave it unoptimized, right? You would find the wasted spend, the right keywords that you're bidding on. Everyone's so focused on one part of the equation of ACoS, which is what you spend, and nobody is focusing on what you make, the revenue side.
Right.
Now imagine a world where you combine both sides of that equation together.
Yeah.
Right, where you're essentially, if you can predict the proper price, you can predict the proper spend at a given price. And now that's really where the holy grail is, where there's a massive monetization opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many aspects of this, and everything gets crushed between the top line and what they are trying to make. And in some cases, you just mentioned that they work with zero margin. In fact, they don't even know. They don't even know, because the only unknown is the percentage of ad spend, right? So that keeps fluctuating. So you don't know where what you are achieving as net margin on the sale of an item at all times.
Yeah, and most agencies and most ad companies aren't actually managing to your profit. So there's already a natural polarization in what the agency wants and what the seller wants or the brand wants. On top of that, they're managing to this mythic gospel metric, which is ACoS, and it doesn't matter. ACoS at the end of the day doesn't matter, right? And the reason why is, like, let's just say you're selling, let's use the same example, this lighter, it's $10 on Amazon. You're spending a dollar. So a dollar for 10, it's a 10% ACoS. Let's just say the price goes now to $12 with the same CPA of a dollar. So you're spending a dollar to make 12. Now your ACoS is 8.3%, right? That's a 12x ROAS, right? And so now, what if you can actually spend a little bit more money, just ever so gingerly, and continuously push price up, and now you're actually unlocking more profit?
Mm-hmm.
So I can increase my price by 20%, I can increase ACoS by 20%, and I can actually increase my EBITDA by 50%.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I give you one more that I always say, if you saw any of the episodes, I always say there are two magic bullets for success on Amazon, and neither one of them is price. One is the click-through rate. So if you figure out a way to increase your click-through rate, then you are effectively bringing more eyeballs to your product page. And the second one is the conversion rate. So now you add this powerful dynamic with pricing, and ACoS becomes almost irrelevant. Yep. Because between playing the conversion rate and the pricing together, that's ultimately what's going to give you the most return. Have you been able to find any patterns or anything between the price changes and the conversion fluctuations?
Oh, I mean, for sure. There's a massive correlation between the two. I want to just get back to something you said real quick, which is the click-through rate. So when people search a product on Amazon, and in fact, and now Amazon's allowing you to buy directly from the SERP without going to the listing. I don't know if you saw that enhancement on some of the product category pages or on the SERP pages, but if you're searching a product, there's pretty much like five things to really help you decide if you're going to click through the product, right? It's the image, if it stands out. Right, the quality and the quantity of the reviews, it's the price, and it's whether it's Prime or not. And perhaps like if it has a coupon, small business coupon, small business icon or a coupon or some sort of promotion, but those are the first things people see when they're checking out on Amazon, which affects your click-through rate. And the higher the click-through rate, the more the chances are that you're going to have more demand going to that product detail page, which you'll have more conversion happening.
Right.
So, for example, like I'm going to Costa Rica, and I'm like, I've got all this scrambling to do, and I'm just ordering tons of products because I know, A, I won't be able to get them in Costa Rica. And I'm actually not even looking at any of the signals that I've just shared. I'm buying it. So imagine if you have other people like me that are shopping with intent and contextualizing their purchase, there's really an opportunity to maximize profitability depending on your category and depending on the ASIN and depending on some of those features that I just shared, those variables.
So do you have any data that tells you the kind of fluctuations that your system is achieving for changing the price? What is the what is that?
What's the outcome? What's the result?
Well, not the result. What is the span? You know, is it 10%, 15%? So are you going down? How far down are you going? How far up are you going? Well, what is the system? Not necessarily driven by min-max, but what is the system finding that it can go as far as X percent or as low as X percent?
Yeah. So like I shared, when we bring on somebody, we have something called the hyper-learning phase. And this is the phase in which we observe, we learn, we experiment, we train the model. Typically, it's on a net neutral profit impact basis, and it's between a negative 5% and 5%. That's our limit during that period. And sometimes we go a little bit beyond. We push the limits a bit in the threshold to see how competition reacts. And then from that, we take our learnings and we go into the hyper-learning phase. The hyper-learning phase is typically a three-month period. And our team is every day analyzing the numbers. We're supervising our AI. So it's not AI running by itself, but we're supervising it so that if there are anomalies, we can detect them and right the ship and make sure that we're protecting the integrity of your product detail page on Amazon. So what we're seeing as a result of the hyperlearning and all the technology that we built, because we actually have an AI per ASIN. So that's also a big deal, right? Every ASIN gets their own AI model that's purpose-built for the specific product and for all of its competitors. It's actually pretty amazing. And the results of all of these things that we built, and we have a long way to go, don't get me wrong, like we're still in the first inning of prophecy. Sometimes we're seeing a 6 or 7% lift in profit. Sometimes we're seeing a 10%. For some customers, we see a 30% lift. So it's pretty significant. Results that we're seeing. And so we're collecting all those case studies now and going to be even having more of those featured on our website. But to me, that's amazing, right? There's nothing that actually warms my heart more than seeing us deliver more profit to clients and then that our technology is working.
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely. I understand that because we've got a platform and then it reports the data points for each listing. And then, but most important, it visualizes it, and then it gives it to you over time. So I have some sellers plug into it, and they've never really looked at it. Frankly, you know, it's the business reports give you the big picture, and they've downloaded their business reports and looked at it maybe a few times, but they don't really know. As you know, most people don't know how to use data. So they've really just downloaded it a few times, looked at it, and then now, and they're just running with it. So we plug them in and then we get 2 years of data. And then when they see it and their conversion rate is like 2%, 2.5%, and they're spending advertising dollars, and they had no idea because the agency that they were using or the consultant that was helping them was focused on ACoS. But the whole machinery, so to speak, that they have. Mm. So when they see that 2.5, 3%, it's provided that it's not a high ticket item and a very heavy, busy category. But so to be able to see, so that's why, and then they start to achieve a 10, 12, 15%. I mean, you can imagine to go from 2, 2.5 to 10%, that's a huge jump. And especially if you're doing volume. So I was wondering what kind of an impact your system was making. So you're telling me up to 30% sounds, it's a big deal.
Yeah, so it's a profit number, right? So we care about profit lift and profit dollars. That's our North Star, that's our metric. And it's crazy that price can impact not only your profit, right? But there's another layer that we can talk about, which essentially you apply a multiple on that of 3.5 or 4x, which is a lot of these Amazon brands are getting acquired at, even right now. And it's a 4x of whatever profit you've gotten from your ASIN that now increases the enterprise value of your company.
Sure, of course. Yeah. So I have a question. I thought of a scenario. So if everybody had your system and they were changing their price dynamically based on all these factors, That would be one thing, but that's not the case. So you have majority of the sellers, private label sellers, they are just assigning the price and they just assign it and then leave it. They don't do anything. Now, in the process, the demand goes up and they run out of stock, whatever. So all the good circumstances start to materialize and then your system starts to increase the price. So you now you're going to be overpriced because they don't really use it. So it doesn't that present an advantage?
So I think two things. One is I think the people that are quick to embrace AI now are going to have a significant competitive advantage of people that don't embrace it, right? So you're going to have sort of the haves and the have-nots. That's always happens in any new technology, right? You have the early adopters, you have the laggards, and you have the people that never adopt it, and those are the ones that are left behind. This next step is, okay, well, does prophecy have any copycats, right? Will and then the question is, well, is their AI going to be as good as ours, right? Is their model going to be a year behind us? Because the beautiful thing about AI is that it's essentially self-learning and it becomes a competitive moat. Not only does it become a competitive moat for me and prophecy and my team and my company and the value we're building, but also for the retailer. Mm-hmm. Now, if everybody is using prophecy, which I would love for that to happen, the beautiful thing is well, the model will have even more information to cross-learn and see, well, what is the optimal price based on a specific ASIN in a specific category based on a specific keyword? So if anything, it'll actually be more informative, right? And we'll be the third party that holds that data so we can make the right decisions to maximize for both sellers. Because like when you make a change in price, it also has a knock-on effect not only on your listing, but also on your competitors that are in that keyword. And we'll figure out what is the sweet spot across a specific keyword.
So, I mean, this is fine. I'm just thinking of the scenario for the guys who don't use AI and they will always be priced low. So, and then your system will look at the demand and everything and increase the price, but they'll always be cheaper. So therefore that's what I'm.
So first of all, I don't think that the humans that are going to be managing their price, which will be extinct over time on Amazon, they just leave their price. That doesn't mean it's the optimal price. It means that they've just left their, like most people are just statically pushing a price to the channel. They have no intention behind that price. They don't know if it's the right price. They don't know if they're leaving money on the table, right? So I think we're crossing paths in a way, because I believe that if you're going to be doing it the manual way and you're doing it as a human and you're not leveraging AI, you're going to be left behind. I think actually I made a post about this on LinkedIn yesterday, which is if you look at the year 2000, Wall Street had less than 10% of its trading volume run by algorithms. 20 years later, 2020, 73% of Wall Street, where it has essentially rendered humans to be mere observers of the market, while the AI and the black box models do their thing. And there's always going to be these like mom and pop traders, right? The E-Trade, the Fidelities of the world, people that are just buying and selling, going long on specific stocks where they find value. And prophecy is technically doing what Wall Street did in 2000, which is we're now adopting and arbitraging the difference between the price that somebody is willing to pay versus the price that you have on the product. And we're figuring out what that spread is. And we're giving that money back to the seller. Yeah. So in my vision of, if you look 20 years out on Amazon, the marketplace, and Amazon's still around, you're going to have a world that you won't even recognize, where it's literally AI that's driving most of the decisions and taking these brands into new heights.
Yeah. Well, totally unrelated to pricing discussion. I don't know. I don't think it's going to take 20 years. I don't think it's even going to take 5 years, frankly. My prediction about Amazon is they're going to either stop selling their own products or create a different marketplace, because they are under a lot of pressure because they have all the data. So you know, the Congress is putting, you know how it is, when the Congress goes after you, then forget it. That's why I always say one of the stupidest things, even though as smart as he is, one of the stupidest things Mark Zuckerberg said was, we need regulation. So, you know, you invite the government to bring your regulation. So good luck. So now there's a lot of pressure. And, you know, I don't know if you saw that they released that report for the Congress, disclosed some numbers, how many sellers, how many this, how many that. So, and there's, it frankly, if you think about it, they know everything, and there's nothing stopping them from replicating exactly what a little guy is doing very well, and then completely killing them. So
yeah, I think the good news about that is that I think Amazon shuts down a lot of their own private label because that's not where their margins are. Yeah. The marketplace used to generate most of Amazon's margin, and now it's AWS. But it's like, I believe it's AWS, advertising, and the marketplace, like carrying their own inventory of products. I think they only carry, Amazon only sells 5% of their catalog. I think Amazon is not interested in playing that game anymore. They're playing a different game.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's smart. It kind of reminds me of what happened with Microsoft when government sued Microsoft and to split them. And the government solution was separate the operating system from Office. Well, what Microsoft got ready for, but never really needed to do it because they won the case ultimately. They created four companies. One was Office, one was operating system, Xbox, and server, I believe a server. So they ordered, and they assigned the individual presidents. So it was, they treated them, even though they were divisions, they treated them like a separate company, created the whole infrastructure. And when I read the news somewhere, it wasn't really like publicized very much. And I said, look, they are just taking a preemptive action. Just in case government comes back, that says, we're going to split you into two. Well, here, you have four. So yep. I think Amazon is already going in that route, but there's still a lot that they are obviously carrying. So this is great, Chad. So I have one question I ask everybody, and you have been around Amazon a long time. So what do you see as Amazon doing better for sellers? Because they're always customer-centric, but they treat sellers really badly. So what do you think Amazon can do to improve in their policies?
Well, if you ask 100 customers if they love Amazon, 99 of them, their hands will go up. If you ask 100 sellers if they love Amazon, I think you're going to have one hand go up. maybe two, because they pay the bills, right? But I think Amazon has always deprioritized sellers and has prioritized the experience of the customer. And that's been a competitive advantage for them. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. They have put things into place where they have people listening more to like Twitter, you know, Twitter posts or LinkedIn posts when people need help and they've been suspended for, I've had my fair share of suspensions for really horrible reasons. And I felt the pain in my stomach, wanting to throw up because I'm like, have all these people employed and Amazon just literally removed my account for me changing a credit card, right? For just updating my bank account information. Amazon just was like, detected some fraud and was like, we're shutting the seller down. So I've had my fair share of that. And it's so unfortunate. I think just at the scale and at the escape velocity that Amazon operates in, it's part of doing business and they can't handle all the sellers. What is there, like 4 million, there's 5 million sellers on Amazon. It's just the scale, the sheer scale and volume is just massive.
Yeah. And the other thing that's going on is this is a highly detailed business, right? So you have to really pay attention to detail. You have to be precise with everything you're doing. And they're a process-driven company. There's a workflow for everything. So people don't have that depth of understanding or the patience to learn it. So in the process, they need serious help. And instead of getting easier, it gets more difficult. However, I have seen some efforts, like, for example, one client the other day, and they had a warning in their account help page, and there was an icon to click for more information, and that went straight to a call. Like, you could request a call right there, and then the guy spent like 20 minutes talking, not saying much, nevertheless, but there was a human being based in the U.S., so they seem to be doing things, but the quality does not seem to be there.
By the way, that's not actually Amazon. That is a software provider that has that third-party app that connects to prevent returns from happening.
Really?
So like nothing Amazon, okay. I don't want to say nothing that Amazon does, but most of the things that Amazon does isn't actually there to benefit the seller, right? It's there to benefit the customer. So I forgot the name of the company that does it. I can find out for you. I'm literally looking it up right now. Here it is. What does he run? Give me 1 second. I'll get it for you in a second. But essentially nothing they do is benefiting the seller. It's to benefit the customer that's buying the product.
Yeah, they are extremely sensitive to the customer's needs, but sellers... So one guest said they should first then ask questions when it comes to sellers.
Mm-hmm.
You are guilty until proven innocent for anything that they think you may have done.
It's called the on-site program. So on-site. Super cool software. So like, there's all these softwares that are out there that are enabling and helping sellers. For example, if you get suspended on Amazon, there's a service for you, right? If Amazon is making mistakes on fees, right? There's a service that helps you get reimbursements. If you're getting a lot of returns, there's a service that helps you prevent returns and allows you to, give the seller a call before making the return.
Yeah.
So that is definitely happening and very prevalent in the space. And I remember when I was suspended, I did hire some help, and I reached out to everybody on LinkedIn that was running support at Amazon, and I found one guy that was like, okay, I'm going to help you, I'm going to create this ticket, and I got reactivated, which is amazing. So it's about like hard work, hustle, and like doing what others aren't willing to do, because this is my, at the time, right, Amazon was everything to me.
You have to submit this plan of action, and then they come back. The trouble with the suspensions is not, you can deal with the suspension, but the process of giving them what they want and then them coming back and saying, give it to me again, and they ask for the same things over and over and over, and it just goes from one person to the other. I had a guest, and she actually runs a consulting operation just for suspensions.
Yep, and exactly.
She said that they have a quota, and this quota is every specialist has X number of minutes to close a suspension ticket. So they just, that's how they are operating. I had an Amazon, former Amazonian, and he said, same thing. It's all numbers driving. So what I'm hearing
from you is, I get it. It's the time to resolution is very important.
Right.
It's not about you just responding back to a customer. It's time to resolution. So they bring things to resolution, they close out the ticket, and they still haven't solved your problem. They should be measuring like how many of those tickets have been reopened. I'm curious if they're measuring that, but that's
I don't think so. Yeah. So what I'm hearing from you is, don't expect too much from us to change.
Basically, what I'm saying is like, the world is your oyster. And if Amazon makes a change, like, you can't depend on someone like in seller support to save you. You have to put yourself out there, and what you put in is what you'll get out of it.
Exactly. Yeah. You need to have your own network. For new ones, I especially say for the new ones, you need to have a mentor. You can't be learning this on the, on the go, because the costs are incredible. You're going to risk your inventory, you're going to risk your cash balance and everything. It makes no sense. But a lot of people you know, the penny wise, pound foolish. So that's the way it works. So Chad, I want to learn. Let's get to know you a little bit. So tell us, where did you grow up? Let's start from there. So, you know, both you and I are Eeyores. You know, when we do our prep for coaching and for presentations, we go why seven times. So let's go back to the beginning. So tell us, where did you grow up?
Let's see. Well, I grew up in Westfield, New Jersey. I was born in New York. I can go on and on about my upbringing, but essentially I was raised in a family.
What I'm always interested in is this. When you were a kid growing up, was this business approach, was this like the culture in the family at home? Did your how did your parents treat you when you wanted things?
Yeah, so it's a great question and a very deep question. So one is, my parents were entrepreneurs, but they were always struggling entrepreneurs. So we would we were never really able to make ends meet. We lived from credit card to credit card. And so first of all, it forced me to mature very early as a young child. I think there was a sense of dysfunctional components in my family, and I was always there to try to carry my family forward. I even started my own business. People say, well, how long have you been an entrepreneur? I'm like, wow, I think I started selling my first item in elementary school. I was selling Warhead snacks, like these like sour candies that you eat. And so I learned at a very early age of how to survive and how to thrive and try to live on my own, so to speak.
Yeah, do you have any brothers, sisters?
Yeah, and it's funny. I have a sister, she's 18 months old, and it's almost as if we live in different, we lived in different childhood homes, even though we're 18 months apart. She's very different than I am, right? We have different roles as children growing up in the family.
So she didn't experience that struggle that you experienced by your parents.
I mean, I think she observed it, but I think there was a difference of how we dealt with the struggle, right? Like for me, I was like going to my father's store. My father owned a vacuum store, which is how I got into the Amazon vacuum space. And I would go in the weekends, I'd help my father sell vacuums, I'd help him repair vacuums. I would help him do his window displays. And, you know, back then, like when growing up in the 90s, right, there was no Amazon at the time, there was no e-commerce. So like brick and mortar was the thing to do. And I would go in and try to help him as much as I could.
So I wonder why you become entrepreneurial in an entrepreneurial family and your sister didn't have that interest.
Yeah.
Do you think it was nurtured or it was just nature that drew both of you this way?
You know, I think it's the way that I view life is that you're on a canoe or you're on a rowboat and the current is taking you, but you also have paddles. So after I got through growing up with my family and I saw what entrepreneur life was like, I said, I never want to be an entrepreneur and I never want to be in the vacuum industry. So I was a first generation college graduate. I studied finance because that's where my parents were deficient. My dream was to go onto Wall Street. And it just so happens, and now that I'm connecting the dots, looking back on it, I studied finance. I went onto Wall Street. I covered Amazon as a stock. I was providing hedge funds and institutional investors to buy, sell, or short stocks. And I got fired Friday the 13th, 2009. And at that point, a new opportunity arose, right? Like one door closed, another door opened. Sure. And I had an opportunity. I was like, okay, let me give this a shot. I started helping my father again. And it's going back to old ways, right? I was helping him growing up. I started helping him once I was let go on the street. I didn't have any income. And then I started to actually see progress and see results. So I kept on doubling down on the results that I was seeing and we built a very sizable company.
And what was the help for? What kind of business?
Well, my father had this vacuum store and I was, even on Wall Street, I was helping my father sell on Amazon, resell.
Oh, okay.
We were reselling vacuum parts, vacuum filters, vacuum bags on Amazon. We were just reselling. And When I was let go, Obama had a retraining program for Photoshop. I started then creating my own infographics for photos on Amazon. I was like, wait, why are we reselling? Why don't we sell direct to consumer? So I started selling direct consumer. I carved out my own niche and found my own category to sell in because I love coffee. So I started moving into coffee filtration products. And yeah, that's sort of how I got my start. So, you know, a lot of people say, I don't want to grow up to be my parents, and they grow up to be their parents. Well, I didn't want to grow up to be an entrepreneur, and I just ended up taking a real liking to it because I think it's what I knew and it was what I was raised with growing up.
Yeah. So I'll, you know, the canoe example is a good example. I'm going to give you a different version of it.
So, yeah, I'd love to hear it.
I wanted to learn windsurfing. So we had a little holiday house in a small, you know, resort. And one of the guys, but this is like, I'm very young. I'm like 17 years old or so. And then one of the guys, his dad got him a windsurf. And he's doing windsurfing and spending hours. And then one day I said, can you teach me? And then he said, sure, of course. And I could never handle this thing. It was terrible. And I totally gave up. I said, this is not working. I got on it. And then a couple of times I got on it. It just wouldn't work. And then I fell on sea urchins, completely destroyed my foot and everything. So that was my experience. And then a few weeks go by. And then, you know, another guy shows up with a windsurf. And he's like doing totally different. And the next thing is, he says, well, come, I'll show you. So I said, no, it's not for me. And when I told him why, he said, you know, try this one. It was a totally different board. So what kind of canoe you end up on?
True, you're right. It's not just, it's like the kind of paddles that you have, whether the boat has a hole in it.
Yeah, right? I mean, you are dealt the hand that you are dealt. And then that's, you do things with it. But I think you got a pretty good canoe in the first place. And then that canoe was really nurtured. I think working with your dad was a big deal. He must be really proud of you now.
My father has passed. Oh, but I do think he's...
But he saw your success.
He actually didn't see all the success, unfortunately. But I think he's looking down from wherever he is and thinking about me. But to the point about the canoe, like, I think, I guess I like the mindset shift around, like, anybody, I try to think that anybody can try to elevate themselves if they can actually find those opportunities. Like, I don't like to use a narrative of, because I grew up like poor, but I was damn hungry and very driven. Right. And so I like to say I had a PhD growing up in entrepreneurship, which I had no opportunities. I paid my way through school. I had to figure it out. Sure, I'm lucky to be living in the United States during all of this, and lucky e-commerce. I was at the intersection of e-commerce, and there's so many great things that happened, but I worked my butt off to make it happen.
Yeah. You know what I would say, Chad? I'd say you have a PhD in attitude. I think attitude, you know, in EO, we say hire slow, fire fast.
Yeah.
And you hire for knowledge and experience, and fire for attitude. So attitude is everything. I think you had the right attitude. But, you know, again, you know, I don't want to say the word but this is in addition to having the right attitude. You had the environment to grow that attitude, because it's all your environment, right? So we are growing up in an environment, then it becomes part of us. So this was great. So Chad, give us the contact information. How can people reach you and look at your prophecy and learn more about it?
Yeah, I also want to say thank you for the vulnerable questions. It's not always that I get to go down memory lane and think about where I came from and what I had to go through to get here today. My contact.
You know, I love dessert, and I go to some restaurants just for dessert. And then finally, when the dessert comes, I say, you know, all the stuff that I've had to eat, really, it's just to get here. I can't just come here and order the dessert. So you have to go through the first dish and the second. So this is the favorite, the most favorite part of my podcast, because I get to learn about what makes the person who he or she is. And but we can't have this conversation right off from the get-go.
Yeah. Well, if you're interested in more around pricing, if you want, I mean, I'm very, very focused on AI and the Amazon community and leaving the community better than how I found it. My personal contact details are just chad@prophecy.com. That's P-R-O-F-A-S-E-E, profit, you could see. So it's chad@prophecy.com. You can find me on LinkedIn. I'm posting on LinkedIn all the time. I'm posting on Twitter. Just trying to give back to the community and share my thoughts openly and transparently.
Great. Thank you, Chad. Thank you for being here and sharing your wisdom and your story.
Thanks for having me.
We'll do too. And this brings us to the end of another episode, and I'll see you on the next one.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. Be sure and subscribe, rate, and review our show. And be sure and share an episode with a friend. And thank you so much for being with us today. We'll see you next week here on Amazon Legends.